You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Bienvenidos. What do we got today?
Fire away, dude.
So I've been reading Myth of Male Power. Mm-hmm. I'm probably 20-30% of the way through at this point. It is a bit repetitive, and I'll start with my criticisms. It does get a bit repetitive, but I think that's part of the value of the book. For those of you who didn't check out what we did last week, it's a book by this guy Warren Farrell, and the thesis of the book is that we recognize the ways in which, or many of the ways in which, women uniquely struggle and suffer in the world. Like, they're more likely to be victims of rape. They're more likely to deal with workplace sexual harassment, those sorts of things. We don't recognize the ways in which men uniquely suffer, and it has led us to incorrectly assume that we have this patriarchal society that favors men, when in reality, what we have is a society that favors the men and women at the top and screws a lot of the people at the bottom. And they can be guys or girls or whatever. So anyway, I've continued reading it. It is a bit repetitive. That's one criticism. Another criticism that I have of it is that, and this, we talked about this with Cowspiracy, how, like, he'll use arguments that aren't valid for the point that he's trying to make, and it unfortunately for me discredits much of what he says. So
you're saying he'll say something, you know it's not a valid argument,
yeah,
and you go, well, did I just miss why the other arguments,
correct,
were invalid?
So for instance, and I wrote one or two of them down, he says that he uses the amount of searches that Google returns when you type in a topic as a proxy for if this thing is being important or is addressed. And it's just like, you know, when you search men's health, you only get this many reviews, but when you search women's health, you get this many results. And I just find that to be, like, so stupid. Mm-hmm. Like, who cares? There's got to be a better way to prove this point. Another thing that he says is that he talks about war, which is a big part of his argument, I think is well-founded, that we send young boys to just die and fight for us. But he phrases it often in such a way that it's like, young men go and fight and women stay at home and are protected. It's like, well, not entirely. Like, sometimes those young men conquer a town and kill all the women or rape them. Like, he can sometimes minimize, and I don't think he does as a human being, because I've seen him talk about it, and I don't see this, but this book was written in 1993, and I do get the sense that he feels like he's fighting an uphill battle, so he has to not talk about the problems that women face, and sometimes just says things like treating war as an exclusively male-dominated suffering event, when in reality it's just, it's brutal for everyone, and men exclusively have made up the frontline fighters, which is a fair point.
Yeah, but when you get to a village and you burn it down, mostly the women are there because the men are all fighting.
Yes.
And you know what's interesting? This is actually a point I was thinking about for a Charisma on Command video. When you present in an argument, let's say I'm trying to persuade you of anything. Mm-hmm. If I present you with four arguments, you will just attack the weakest one.
Correct.
So people think that when they're trying to prove that someone's wrong or a bad roommate or a Republican or Democrat is bad, the more things they can throw at them, the better. So if I can list 10 reasons why you're a bad person, that's better than four. But actually, the person is going to try to fight you because they don't want to be a bad person. They don't want to be wrong. So the weakest thing you present them with is exactly where they'll attack you. Mm-hmm. And they won't address your strongest points. So it's interesting that you raised this with the book too. It seems like there's this misconception that more is better when trying to be persuasive. And actually, yep, I think stronger is better.
I think that there are cases where more can be better, where you can overwhelm someone who is not digging in their feet resistant with just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
I think more works when the person wants to buy your narrative. Mm. So for instance, if you're trying to cancel Jake Paul,
yes,
and you just go, yes, Jake Paul,
did this
thing that's bad. And they go, okay, that's one bad thing. You go, he did this thing that's bad. And also these five things that aren't technically bad, but they're just kind of shitty.
Yeah.
To someone who already wants to not like Jake Paul or hates Jake Paul, it's like, oh, there's six really strong reasons to hate Jake Paul. So this, I think it helps with confirmation bias.
Brian Callen's Me Too moment was a lot like this. Though there was one, like, he drugged my drink and raped me. And then there were others that he propositioned me for sex for money. He was creepy. He was, and I was going, like, why are these even in here? These
have, yeah, why are these lumped together? And because I'll tell you, when you drug someone and rape them, yeah, it's a crime, and you go to jail for it. And when you make a joke at a comedy club that's inappropriate, yeah, you don't go to jail.
Or even
for
if you proposition someone for sex and you mean it sincerely, it's like these aren't in the same ballpark.
Yeah.
But the reason is, if you are likely to buy that, the headline says, Brian accused by four women of sexual assault related.
Yeah. If you're not arguing against someone who's going to think critically about it, I guess then it's helpful,
because
you can just say, oh, five allegations of misconduct.
Yes.
One of them is a horrific allegation, and the other four are not. And but you don't necessarily need more than the headline.
If you're predisposed to believe that, the five feels good to you. Yeah. So,
but I think if you're going to sit down with someone who's intelligent or going to be critical of your argument, that the weakest thing you present is what they're going to attack.
Sure. I think that's a correct way of breaking it down. But so other things, things that I liked a lot of it though. So he gave me really what he does is for this section is he shines a light on the left side of the bell curve of men. And it is incredible how I didn't know that, like, garbage men is the fifth most dangerous job in America. Apparently in 1993, at least, I don't know if this is still true, like, they get maimed constantly.
By the garbage truck
and other things. Like, stories of battery acid falling out on them. Their backs get screwed up. They are the butt of every joke. And it's not even jokes. Like, what, do you want to wind up as a garbage man?
Like, yeah, that's the elementary school teacher threat.
Yeah.
If you don't pay attention, you'll be a garbage man.
And he's like, even within the thing, if there are garbage women, they're X times more likely to be driving the car rather than in the back handling, which is where the danger tends to occur and happen. And he, I think effectively, though repetitively, but sometimes you need repetition, goes through a variety of different jobs and circumstances where it's... The truth, yeah, we put men in dangerous positions. That's what we have done throughout history. When there's a war, when there's dangerous work to be done, we put young men there first. And we bait the hook, oftentimes in war, with promises of you'll be a hero or prestige, or you're a tough macho guy. And so that was one thing that I have. I'm going to try to keep my eyes open more. He talks about how there are invisible men, and I can totally relate to this, is that you do not see those people. Like, when you walk down the street, one of the things that can happen in LA is that homeless people can become invisible if they're not screaming at you. Like, you can just get blinded to it. And you'll notice somebody walking past you and you'll make eye contact, but there's an invisibility that occurs with homeless. And I think he correctly points out that same thing occurs with the guy fixing the power lines, the garbage man, the steel worker, mining, all of these kinds of things. And I don't encounter miners, but you just... They're overlooked. Their problems are not discussed ever. And mining is apparently, like, the most dangerous thing. Truckers, for instance. This is another one that he mentions. And I'm curious if you find this to be true. The representation of truckers in media is often stupid or violent. So if you think of, like, Man of Steel, like, Clark Kent walks into a bar and these truckers are, like, cursing him out.
Interesting.
I'm trying to think of a trucker that I've seen in media that has been at all... aspirational, admirable, or likable. And I can't think of...
I think in movies, that's right. For me, when I think of a trucker, I think of just brutal hours. I think of the guy that was in the magazine where half his face is completely wrinkled because
the sun
only hits one side of his face.
Yeah.
So when I think trucker, I just think, oh, brutal hours, brutal days, not a fun job, trying not to fall asleep at the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't necessarily think dumb or violent, but I do think... hard job.
and ridiculously necessary, you know, like until we have autonomous cars.
For now, right?
Until we have autonomous cars, and at which point then what happens? But he does, I think, fairly shine
the
spotlight.
The guy Wolverine fights in the bar.
It's always a trucker. Jerk trucker who is screwing with a superhero. You know what I mean? Yeah. Some arrogant, dumb, violent trucker, or in Dumb and Dumber, you know, it's the jerk in the diner is a trucker.
Yeah.
Which I thought was like, oh, that's interesting.
Do you think truckers are pissed about this? Do you think they just, it's the water that they live in?
I have no idea. They do not tweet about it, as far as I can tell. His point is that men have been taught, one of the weaknesses of this whole thing is that it's very appropriate, he says, that women have complained about the unnecessary roles that they've been forced into. Now that technology can free them from the constraints that we used to have a couple hundred years ago, that they no longer have to be the homemaker and they no longer have to be all of these different things. And men haven't complained. And that's partially because culturally and historically, you don't complain. That's a sign of weakness that you don't want to display as a man.
Well, I think we talked about this a little bit off air. That's because, and I don't know if this is cultural or biological or what, but there's a strong desire by most men to appear strong, to appear stronger than they are. There's a tendency, and maybe this is changing now in the young people, but you don't want to appear sad. You don't want to appear hurt. If someone hurts your feelings in a breakup in high school, you don't show it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you get punched, you're supposed to act like it doesn't hurt. There is an instinct, but I don't know if it's a biological instinct or one built in us from society, to try to front as strong as we can as people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that goes, complaining is the direct opposite of that. And I think that's why a lot of guys don't complain until they're only with their guy friends and drinking. Because at that point, there can be a little bit of you know, bitching about stuff.
Yes. Sure. Yeah, I think that's true. And that is a drawback, at least in the 2021, of the traditional male gender role, is that when there are problems, you're not, and we've talked about this in the past, how you see more depression in women than in men, but there have been people that have theorized that male depression, it's just called alcoholism. It's just called domestic violence. It's just, you know, like it finds other outlets than I'm sad. It comes out in I'm angry, or I'm going to hurt someone, or, you know, I kill myself, basically. Yeah. But I was never depressed at any point. I just killed myself.
Yeah. One thing we've talked about, I'm bouncing around a little bit, but the other thing is the ability to control a man by telling him that a certain behavior makes him more of a man versus less of a man, or a more desirable man to women versus less desirable. That's something I noticed in my past. Yeah, you could so easily manipulate me by just saying that something made me masculine or that something was not masculine. So when I was reading a book that said that being masculine meant no matter how, I don't know how do I say this not offensively, no matter how your girlfriend is behaving, your job as a man is to be the rock with which she can rage against.
This book is The Way of Superior Man, and that like most wonderful things, I think we would agree with like 85% of this book, and which is why we just took it all wholesale. But one piece that you're describing,
well, it's just like, oh, men, what men do when things are crazy around them is be the person that stands against the hurricane winds and just lets them bounce off him. And that led me to stay in a bad relationship because I thought that's what a man did.
Yeah,
and
it's like, of course she's going to be the hurricane. It took me,
I had to reframe that. I was like, no, a man is someone that demands behavior from the people around him up to a certain standard and then leaves when it's not. And it's like, oh, okay, cool. Now I can leave because I've reframed what being a man is. But what I couldn't do is just go, okay, this might be what being a man is, but it's not fun. I'm not enjoying this anymore. So I'm just going to go be feminine over here and happy. Yeah. I like still can't do that. Yeah. I had to reframe like, oh no, it's cool because being a man means that when someone doesn't act the way that you expect them to in a relationship, you leave with your masculinity. So yeah, I think that's often, you see it all the time in Twitter bios or Tinder bios and stuff like, oh, if you're not man enough to deal with the fact that I have, and then just a list of terrible qualities.
I mean, think of what a draft is. Like, he didn't point this example out, but if you remember when Bill Clinton, you know, and George Bush went to the National Guard, dodged the draft. Bill Clinton ran away. That was a smear on him. When Hillary Clinton, who is the same age, ran for president, the same position, and didn't fight in Vietnam, nobody said a fucking word.
Yeah, of course.
and the fact that that had never occurred to me, I was like, oh my God. Like, and I do like, oh yeah, George Bush, rich kid, went to the National Guard. It's like, and again, I'm not saying that we should have gone to Vietnam, but like, where was his wife at the time? Why no criticism of her? Did she put her life on the line? Of course not. Like, why would she? So I think he correctly points out this expectation that we have as men as to lay your life down and be a bodyguard for society and women. And that if we want to really reassess gender roles, I think he correctly points out that this bodyguard position is one that we should question. Collectively. Now, that's not to say, and I'll go the best. If there is a war, you want the most capable, physical specimens who are most likely to win the war to be there. That wasn't how we did it. You know, we have female firefighters. We have, you know, like, and there's, yeah, we have.
Well, his point is not one that people would necessarily accept, or his ideal is not one that everyone agrees with, though. His ideal is, let's just treat everybody the same, basically. Let's just not even take gender into.
I think it's a bit more nuanced than that. It's to recognize that the gender roles that persist today had extreme relevance for a large portion of human history. Like, it made sense to go, oh, you've got a penis, you should probably be out there hunting. Okay, you don't, you should take care of the home. You know, like, hey, oh, but I'm just saying, there's, you should probably be going and you should probably not be.
What I'm saying is there's men and women who absolutely still want the traditional roles.
Sure.
There's men and women who want, okay, man, you go make the money, you be the bodyguard. Mm-hmm. Woman, you take care of the kids, take care of the house. There's people of both genders that are very happy to sign up for that still. So not everyone has adopted this. What's his name? Warren Farrell?
Warren Farrell, yeah.
Like, no one's, not everyone's adopted that mindset yet of, let's just treat ourselves as identical in terms of our interests and capabilities.
Yeah, I agree. But he's really moved me. I guess one of the big shifts that I've been thinking about this week is I've really been questioning that. So, because here's the thing that you don't realize is that what if you could pick and choose, which is what we've, which is really what the women's lib movement has attempted to offer women, is the ability to pick and choose which role you'll play. You could still play the female role, or you could play the traditional male role, or you could do a hodgepodge of both of those, right? You could be the high-powered executive, but you could also, you know, love to cook and clean and those sorts of things if that suits you. So what I've been going is, look, I do like earning money and providing. And if I were to be married, I'd be happy to be a single income earner. But if I was like, if someone breaks into my house, do I want to be the bodyguard? I'm not sure. He raises the interesting point. And I don't know that I could ever let go of the cultural conditioning. And I imagine if I love someone to that degree and I had kids in the house, I probably would lay down my life for them. But I don't have that, so it's tough for me to say. But he does point out that we often talk about how stay-at-home moms, they're not compensated for their work, and it's a fair point. Like, they do all the cooking, the cleaning, the this and that, and they don't receive a salary, and they're not recognized economically. But he also says that men in relationships are socially expected to play the role of bodyguard, such that if you are attacked or somebody comes into the house and there's a baseball bat, you don't grab the bat and give it to your wife and say, go get him, honey. You know, I'm going to stay up here, and if I hear something, I'll scream and call 911 and then maybe, like, dip out the window. Whether or not you have training, you're going down the stairs with the bat, and it's probably nothing. But if it's someone, you're going to slow him down while she escapes. And, you know, when the Titanic went down, it didn't matter who could swim better. Women and children got on the boats, and men didn't. Like, is there a reason for that necessarily in that particular circumstance? No, it's that there was this whole cultural thrust of the disposable sex in terms of laying down their life, not in terms of, like, whose opinions matter more. And I think there's fair criticism that the opinions of women had not been held as in high regard throughout history. But when it came to, like, who's going to die, the answer was men.
Yeah, yeah. Well, sorry, but I'm saying even in the, like, even the people I know who identify as feminists, most of them still expect that the man will pay on the first date and probably more than half of the subsequent dates. I don't actually see a lot of people pushing for this Warren Farrell ideal.
This is why he wrote the book.
Going 50-50. That's what I'm saying. I don't actually, if you want that, it sounds like he has a lot of good prescriptions and ideals for how to do that, but I don't see men or women really wanting that. I think a lot of men like pursuing masculinity and being rewarded for it, even if it's just with a pat on the head from society. And I think even the feminists I know would be
turned off
or offended by being asked to go 50-50 on a first date.
Or if a man gave them the baseball bat while they were in the house together. I mean, they might say that they want that level of equality, but there's no way they would stay with someone who they didn't feel would protect them in the event of, or at least attempt to, in the event of some sort of an attack.
Yeah, there's just still, even from the people who identify as feminists that I know, there's still a expectation that first date, the guy's going to get the wallet.
Sure.
And I think what they expect to do is say, oh, no, I'll split it. And then they expect the guy to say no. Mm-hmm. And if he says, yeah, that sounds like a great idea, that's not what they're solving for. Yeah. So this guy's, I guess what I'm saying is this guy's prescriptions are kind of for a solution that people aren't asking for.
Well, yes. And he starts by saying, this is what, look, if you want equality and you want to really question gender roles, this is what it would entail. It's mm-hmm. got to cut both ways in terms of advantages and disadvantages. And I think that's the fairest point. Like, I'm not saying that I can totally release the masculine ideal that has been instilled in me since I was a little boy and let go of that. But to recognize, I think, that men and women face different challenges, which the other will likely only know intellectually and never have to experience. And to say that history is simply a patriarchy is to miss that there were also tremendous advantages of being a woman that are taken for granted in current discourse. That's the big thing.
Got it. Makes sense.
And so, but the other, so I mentioned this to you, so it might not be as interesting for us to discuss, but for the audience's sake, he does raise the interesting question of homosexuality, which I was fascinated by this bit. So the basic idea is that in many cultures, with rare exception, you could probably think of a few, homosexuality, sodomy were condemned. And the question is why? Like, why would that be societally, evolutionarily conditioned? And his answer, which is just a hypothesis, is that it doesn't make babies. And it's too good of a deal. Like, if people, men and women, can get sexual pleasure without producing children, and they tend towards that society will have fewer children and, you know, will be weaker in the event of a war or production or whatever. And so it was just interesting for me to think, oh my gosh, in what would happen in a world of abundance, and it seems to indicate, if this hypothesis is right, is that you'd see a lot more bisexuality and homosexuality. You'd see a lot more people opting out of children because that would be less necessary going forward for the protection of that society.
This is just anecdotal because I don't have a TikTok, but my girlfriend uses TikTok and she happened to be looking at one and I was like, oh, that's funny. Like, she's talking about her boyfriend. She goes, no, she's talking about her girlfriend. And I said, oh, that's interesting. So she's like a famous bisexual TikToker. And my girlfriend's understanding is there's a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And basically that bisexuality is much more widely accepted in people, I don't know, 13 to 22 today mm-hmm. than it was
when we were growing up
50 years ago or 30 years mm-hmm. ago or whatever it was. So that we might actually have that. We might have a lot more people who are young adults who identify as bisexual now than we did in the past.
Yeah.
That's literally just an anecdotal observation from TikTok. Maybe it's not true, but that's my understanding.
Well, and I think trans is a similar idea, which is, look back in the day, like what you felt like on the inside, it was like, it was subservient to survival needs. Like, it's like, you might feel a certain way, but guess what? We don't have enough luxury for you to feel your feelings. You're going out this way, you're going over here. And that's just how it breaks. And we're all going to die anyway. The next tribe invades us. So like, we'll deal with what you feel like later. And now, so that there's a relative level of abundance and these gender roles are not as necessary for survival, you start to see this surge of people coming out as trans. And it's interesting. And I think you're going to see a breakdown of these traditional gender roles, perhaps not too quickly so that we don't lose the things that we still need, but it does seem like we don't need every aspect of gender as we used to.
You do raise an interesting point that I've literally never thought of, which is you don't need a commandment to not cut your own penis off or stab yourself in the eyes, like things that would make you less useful to society, like being blinded or generally incapable of having children. There's no commandment that says, hey, don't cut your penis off and stab your eyes out.
A commandment against suicide.
So,
which is interesting because that's tempting for some.
Well, this is what I'm saying is I guess whoever, well, if you assume that it's written by
the collective intelligence of societies got together to say you can't do gay stuff.
Which meant there was a tendency towards it or an urge for it.
Correct.
That they felt was, they had to curb. Like not, so basically not only was this happening, but this was happening and they felt it was happening too much for the betterment of society.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just one correction. It's not that they felt, it's that the collective wisdom of societal evolution, I imagine that there were some groups where it was like, you know, he talks about a little bit, it's just one example about Tahiti, which is an island, you know, without natural predators and invaders. And it's just like way more free sex, way more do what you want. But yeah, when you put a bunch of competing tribes against one another, the ones that apparently outlaw homosexuality do better, it seems. Or at least those have been the ones that have dominated throughout history, perhaps by accident. But I think he raises a good point that not just by accident. And they also, interestingly, did have some role potentially for homosexual men, and I haven't gone deep into this, in the role of priests. And so there was some space made for like learned scholars who would not participate in the the reproduction of the species, but of some sort of ecclesiastical or like job that they would take.
Well, I used to think that gay and straight was binary.
People are going
to
be mad that I said that historically a lot of gay people were priests. I think, but I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I have heard that hypothesis.
I don't know. I'm not going to touch that. What I say, I used to think gay and straight were binary. And I thought, because gay people say that they were born this way, I just assume, okay, it's nature, not nurture.
Yeah.
And it's binary. And that's just how it breaks out. And it breaks out to be that 10% of the population is born homosexual and 90% are born heterosexual. Until I learned about the Greek and Roman soldiers who were all having sex with each other. And that was very confusing to me because I went, wait, why is this population genetically being born nature-wise with such a larger degree of homosexual tendencies? And that kind of broke my mental model. And that was the part where I switched to saying it's more of a spectrum, which is to say, I think you fall somewhere from absolutely heterosexual and there's nothing society could do to get you interested in same-sex sex. Mm-hmm. Absolutely homosexual, there's nothing society could do to make you interested in the opposite sex. And then people who are in the middle, which goes, if they tell you this is bad, you just won't do it. And you literally won't feel the attraction. You won't have to fight any urges. But if they tell you it's even better than heterosexual sex, all of a sudden you're happily participating. And that was the only way. I don't know if that's the consensus mental model, but that was the only way I could kind of figure out how it would be possible that depending on the society, you would just have a massive amount of the male population that was totally cool with same-sex sex. Because that doesn't hold up if you just assume only 10% of the population is leans towards this and that it's all nature.
Yeah.
But because of my gay friends saying it's very strongly nature and that they felt like this since even before puberty, I was like, okay, there must be something genetic as well as a societal thing. So that's where I came up with, you have a spectrum and then society falls somewhere on the spectrum and then everybody to the left is cool with same-sex and so that's my current mental model.
Sure. I mean, that's Kinsey. That's I think he graded people like 1 to 14 or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I think it's reasonable to assume that if there were gay people, even in ages where it would result in your death, that there's very little choice and it's undeniable at that level. Like if you're going to sneak off and risk death in order to do this. And it's reasonable to say that on the other side, there is at least as big of a heterosexual component, if not much larger, because that's what tends towards the propagation of the species.
That was my thinking. I was like, okay, what's funny enough is even in the Spartans, there must have been someone who didn't do it just because there were people willing to risk their life to not have opposite sex.
I don't know a ton about the Spartans, but I do believe it was a certain segment of the warriors. And in the Greeks, it was a relationship between a mentor and a mentee. Mm-hmm. Like it was curbed to particular relationships is how it was socially expressed and accepted.
Sure, but in the same way that even when a closeted gay man is having sex with his wife, he's not enjoying it. There was someone in the Spartan army that was just putting in the motions because that's what you're supposed to do with your shield buddy who didn't like it.
Yeah.
But I think, it's like there because it exists in the gay community, I assume it exists in the straight community.
Of course, and probably larger is, I think, a safe bet. Probably much larger. But
the fact that there's so many people doing it in a society that encouraged it, I go, oh, there's a lot of us
in the middle
that in a different society might feel differently.
Sure. And that was the question that I was asking myself is if you removed, which you could not have in the past, and I don't want to throw out gender roles and say that they're useless or even that we know the extent of how they still are necessary in 2021. Like, I wouldn't want to just entirely remove them because I'm not that progressive. I think tradition it needs to be slowly displaced so that you don't throw out important stuff. I wonder what that middle, how big that middle chunk is when given freedom, and not just freedom like, oh, it's legally accepted, but socially not frowned upon. And even what you could say is there's I imagine some subcultures in which it is socially encouraged. I don't know if that's TikTok at this point, but where being different from the sexual norm is a badge of honor.
I think for women on TikTok, it's definitely encouraged at this point.
Perhaps. I don't know enough to say. But yeah.
My guess would be...
Go ahead.
What about jail? Isn't that like a widely held belief in like American prison?
That what?
that, like, I guess, like, the bigger guys will, like, go for these, I guess, softer-looking guys.
Softer-looking guys.
Well, yeah. I don't know how true that is. I don't know anyone who's, I mean, I actually know someone who went to prison, but he didn't have that experience. So I don't know if that's something that just comes from movies or not.
Well, I do think, it seems that jailhouse rape occurs more than non-jailhouse rape.
Yeah, but I don't know if it's a, it might be more of a dominance move than a sexual move.
Sure, sure, that's fair. I don't know. I'm really uneducated. I've watched a section of one video that seemed to suggest that in female prisons, there was couplings, like not just like girlfriends were far more common than in the world at large. And I could imagine that even if there were men that were not gay outside of prison, doing gay things inside of prison, you can't totally remove that cultural pressure that everyone grew up with that says that this is not right, and you can't love this person, and it's wrong. And so maybe it has to be expressed as a dominant.
Well, I just don't know. I mean, here's what I know that I don't know. So I don't know if that's true or a movie myth.
Yeah, a lot of speculative.
No, but I'm saying I'm not going to speculate. I don't know if that's true or a movie myth. Yeah. And actually, if it is true that there's more sodomy, let's say, mm-hmm. I actually don't know if that's a sexual expression due to lack of women or a dominance move to say if you do that to someone, that somehow helps you in your survival of the prison environment. I don't know. I have no idea.
Yeah.
So my one friend that went to prison never had any of that experience. Just saw a guy get shanked.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm reading the book. It's interesting. It's a bit repetitive on some of the parts. I do find some of the arguments a bit weak, but it definitely has opened my eyes. And what I mentioned to Ben, I was like, it is crazy that throughout my life, I would never consider doing gay things as like a sexual outlet. And I think the fact is not because I was born so straight or anything. Like, I know that the wall in my brain there was put in there as I grew up. It's like, this is just not something you do. And fortunately for me, it has not been a horrible struggle. Like, I feel lucky to wherever I am, whether it's on the side or the gray zone, it's at a level that is comfortable for me.
I had a friend who was bisexual, and I was like, what is that like? He goes, well, imagine, you know, you walk into a party and you can be attracted to at most half the people at the party. I walk into a room and I go, I could be attracted to 100% of the people here.
Yeah.
That blew my mind. It's like, oh, whoa.
In any event, so this is, do you want to talk about this more? I have just.
No. I feel like we've really honestly stayed almost too long on this.
Cool. So this is totally out of left field, but I was thinking, I saw somebody that does dishonest marketing, and I was critical of them in my mind's eye. And then I thought about what we're doing and if there's anything that's like that. And so there's a handful of areas that I wanted to ask, and I'm curious what the audience thinks. So when I think of what a lie is, it is when you are communicating with someone and you leave out or purposefully misrepresent the truth. Mm. What that requires, though, is an understanding of their understanding of the world. Mm. So if I'm speaking to you and what's a good example? Like, I don't know, if I speak to you in Spanish and you don't hear me, I didn't lie to you. Like, if I say the sky is red in Spanish and you have no idea what I said, I didn't lie because you don't have that understanding. But if you were a Spanish speaker and I said the sky is red, I've lied to you. Now, okay. Is that important? It matters even more if it's a meaningful thing. So if there's some reason where you're going to place a bet on the color of the sky and I tell you that the sky is red and you then go and lose a significant amount of money, that is an even more grievous thing. That's my perspective. So is it meaningful? Is it important to that person? Are you taking their worldview into account? And are you representing an untruth? Because we're always not fully representing the truth because language is constrained. So that's how I try to, like, okay.
Till the Neuralink,
at which point it's just all. So one of the questions that I have is, how do you deal with communicating to mass audiences? This is one of the things that I struggle with on the podcast, which is like, there's somebody out there that when I'm communicating, we're on the level. They get me entirely. I think mm-hmm. you're mostly there. And then there's other people that have such different understandings of the world that they could misunderstand the literal words that I'm saying in such a way that it comes across as a lie. And I think
sometimes some of our audience English isn't their first language. You had a video on Elon Musk where you said mm-hmm. Elon Musk was gifted. And there was a comment saying, how dare you say that Elon Musk is gifted? He worked so hard for everything. No one gifted him anything.
Oh, really?
Yeah, swear to God.
So I would consider, yeah.
And so that's literally you're just misunderstanding the words I'm saying. And I think that.
And so for that, I wouldn't put that on myself. But if I knew that that person didn't understand, this is the question that I have. It's like, if I were speaking to that person and I understood that they didn't have the same vocabulary as me, and I purposely swapped out a word to give them a misrepresentation of reality that wound up harming them. And then when they pointed it out, I said,
Well, so this isn't in the video that's coming out. That's the worst Shark Tank pitch ever. Someone says they use purposely confusing languages so that they say, in this pamphlet, we have 21 clinical trials. And the sharks interpret that as him trying to say they are his trials.
Yes.
But they are not his trials. They're trials he has in a pamphlet. But the interpretation is that he's trying to pass them off as his own. He's trying to make the product seem better. He also says, there was an experiment that we based our first study on. And so it makes it, what's our study if it's not our experiment? Which is just to say that...
You're giving better examples than I was. This guy knows that he is using literally true language to convey an incorrect impression, which is important to the sharks.
The ultimate example would be Bill Clinton sexual relations.
Yes,
so, there you go. So this guy in the Shark Tank pitch, Bill Clinton in the sexual relations, what they're saying is literally true if you lawyer the words, but purposefully meant to give a untrue impression that the clinical trials are theirs or that
there is no sexual relationship with Miss Lewinsky. And what that meant is a present tense verb.
Right.
And we are currently not in a sexual relationship. But he knew what that was communicating was I'd never done anything with her, which was a lie.
And actually, just to credit, I think the Shark Tank example, the guy Manish would argue that it was an accident. Mm-hmm. So he would say he wasn't trying to do it. Mark Cuban would say he was absolutely trying to do it. But I wasn't there and I'm not either of them. So I'm just saying it was interpreted as he was lying.
So this is a question that I have now. With all of that background, we send out, we have an email autoresponder, and it's got my name on it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that most people understand that I did not sit down in front of my computer that day and write them an email.
Yeah.
But I know that some do think that. Some people that have, for whatever reason, have not been on the internet a ton or whatever, like, think that I'm writing them.
You're writing them real time. Because you actually have... Either written or
I've
signed off on
or reviewed every email. Single email.
But what some people might think is that on that day, on April 22nd at 4 p.m., you sat down and typed it for the first time.
Correct. How do you handle that level of honesty? Because I do know that there is a subsection of the audience that probably feels tricked, is tricked. I'm not intending to trick them, but it also is written in a way that is very, it's not written like a newsletter. It is written like a person to person, which to be fair is how I sat down and wrote it. Like I was an individual writing it on a day. Now, one thing that we've had to do, and this might be boring for people, is like I started by being like, last week I bumped into this guy. And then we checked it a year later.
You have to go back and you're right.
This isn't last week. That was last year. And so
it was last week. But then you have to go back and go, there was a time when I bumped into a guy. And so the emails actually get worse, but we try to keep them. So that they're
so we've tried to do that. Legit. I don't know if you have an opinion or the audience has an opinion, but that was just something that I thought. I was like, if there is a false impression that I am giving, I think that is a spot where it would be. It's the email list. It's in people thinking that there is a more of a relationship between them and I than a one-way dialogue.
I'd be curious what the comments think, because to me, being in the world of marketing, that one's an obvious one, but maybe that's because, so anytime I get an email from someone, I know that they might have written this 6 months ago. And I know even if they wrote it that day, it was sent through a software. They didn't actually type in my email address personally. I just would ask the people who are listening, what was your impression of when you get an email from somebody because you signed up for an email list, do you think that they sat down and wrote it that day? Do you think that they personally typed your email in and they're emailing just you? I had assumed that people know that that's not the case, but I would be curious.
Well, here's the question. I know that there's one. I know that there's many who don't. Not that a percentage is going to be easy to find, but what's the percentage at which you hit a tipping point? Which you go, look, 35% of the people think that you're talking to them. You know what I mean? Like they think they...
I really just want to outsource this to people that aren't us, because this is a question I would love. Write in a comment, or at least like a comment that you agree with, so we can get a sense for if this is 95% of people know, 45% of people know. Yeah. I would have guessed it was quite a high percentage, but I could be totally wrong.
Yep, cool. So let me know. Do you have any stuff? I have a handful. But
I think you should just exhaust your list because my stuff's...
Rando?
Well, here, I got one. Okay. I'll do one. So the results published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Did you see this?
No.
They did a study. Two sessions of psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy were as effective in treating depression over the course of 6 weeks as daily SSRIs. Mm. So this is the first ever head-to-head of psilocybin versus an antidepressant.
SSRIs.
It's called Lexapro. Yeah. Normally, you do psilocybin against nothing. And they go, psilocybin is better than nothing. Psilocybin can help depression. But this was the first study they'd done where they go, oh, in every way that we measured it, it's either better than standard antidepressant Lexapro or a tie.
How was it better?
Well, I mean, dude, they have so many. The way they test this is, you know, they have a therapist who's there, and then they have self-reported stuff.
Therapist-reported, got it.
So they did a number of things, and it's kind of hard. Mental health is hard to track. It's not like body fat where you can just, you know, like scan someone. And you're like, oh, this person's this much depressed. But, yeah, it's the first head-to-head one, and they went, wow, this is, I mean, if you were hoping that psilocybin was going to become a popular alternative for treating depression, this was as good as it could have gone.
Yeah.
So this, and yeah, because the thing is, and I just want to explain this, I guess, if people don't know, most of the time you go on antidepressants for SSRIs, you are on them. And when you go off them, you are back to a similar mental health issue. Maybe you're less depressed than you were when you went on them, but like they don't cure you. They are a daily Band-Aid.
Yeah.
And the psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy, it was two sessions, at which point the person felt as good as the people on the antidepressants.
After the psilocybin had left their system.
Right. And, so which is to say that it is making their brain change in a way that's helping them and should, in theory, help them for over a long period of time. And maybe they'll have to go back every couple months to go through it. But that's incredible compared to daily therapy or a daily pill. So yeah, that was a study, and it's very impressive results for psilocybin. Mm.
Yeah. No, I think the one thing that I would say that as having done this now several times is I think it's going to be oversold as a silver bullet. I'm glad they did it twice. I don't think it's going to last forever for these people. It sometimes can, but I think that one thing that's going to have to be careful is as there's a lot of excitement about this stuff, people, this is what happened when I first did it, will tell you, like, this is going to change your life. Mm-hmm. And like, there's going to be a before and an after. And sometimes that can be the case, but I actually think that it is not most commonly the case. But
yeah, but SSRIs don't come with, they're not downside free.
Oh, for sure.
If you can do psilocybin therapy once and then 2 weeks later and then 4 weeks later and then every 3 months for the rest of your life, but not have the risk that comes with a serotonin receptor inhibitor, that is, I think, a better alternative. That's a more appealing alternative to a lot of people.
Yes. Yeah. No, me too. I mean, my mom was in that camp. She was on SSRIs for a long time, got off, struggled, like went to a personal development program, was like, I need to get off these, got off these, had a hard time, and has been doing psychedelics since then. And it's not gotten perfect, but what I've told her, and I believe, is that SSRIs are sometimes necessary, and if you know, consult your doctor. But in her case, I felt that they were a mask. It's like, you haven't addressed any of the underlying issues. Like, you're just taking a mellower every day.
Well, sometimes the other thing is they can flatten your happiness.
Sure.
They can have certain effects, maybe, where they bring your emotions in from both sides. So you just have a tighter range of emotions.
At no point did she think about her past or her family or this or why she's this way. It just, you know, and then you do psychedelics and it's like, oh my God, these flashbacks from my childhood and all these other things. And I could be wrong. And I don't think the story is always necessary. But in reviewing some of that and getting closure on some of that, it does seem to have a longer lasting effect than simply regulating the whatever's being dumped in your brain on a day-to-day basis. So I'm thumbs up for psychedelics. I think everybody knows that who watches this. Any other stuff you got?
Yeah, I got a bunch of stuff. So some race things happened this week. I don't know how much we want to touch on them, but Chauvin is going to jail.
Yeah.
That verdict came out. I have nothing novel to say on it, but
I didn't follow the trial. So,
you know, that happened. Then there was a white cop that shot a black girl who people were very excited to cancel until it came out that the girl he shot was trying to kill another black girl, and he actually saved a girl's life. And then LeBron deleted his tweet, and everybody was, oh, no,
LeBron tweeted, you're next.
The pitchforks came out, and then the pitchforks got put away. And I don't know if you have anything to say, but those were the two biggest news stories of the week.
No, I'm kind of, I mean, you and I have talked a lot offline. I am there is a clear narrative that is popular on Twitter and with many papers, and it's they are searching to seize upon white perpetrators and marginalized victims. And when the narrative doesn't fit that, it's not widely publicized or it is treated as a gun issue. So just for instance, there was a shooting in Austin. That was a police officer. Now, I don't care personally. It was a black police officer, but that is not important to that story. There was an NFL player who killed a family. He was black. I don't care that he was black. The story is that he has CTE, but there was the guy in Colorado who shot up a Kroger. 10 victims were white. Their race was not listed. And so one of the things that I turn it off. I'm getting tired of seeing is like, it seems like a worldview in search of evidence. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be evidence. It's a big country, man. People of all different colors kill each other all the time. And some of them are egregious. But the idea, I think, unfortunately, if you're just sitting back and you're treating the news and Twitter as your eyes, is they have very selective vision. Mm-hmm. And what they're going to report to you is that it happens in a particular way, which is not necessarily representative of a broader statistical view of things. And this is the primary problem. And this is why we talk about not listening to the news. So that's my perspective on it. It seems like a conclusion in search of evidence. And when the evidence, like if the evidence doesn't match, we have mental health crisis or this is CTE. Like it just gets sorted.
Or gun problem.
It gets sorted into some other camp. And I agree, by the way, I think those are the right takes. When an NFL player goes into someone's house and look at his brain, see if there's damage from all of that stuff. Yeah. Like his skin color is definitely like 99.999999999% not the thing that's causing it. I only leave that 0.000001 because anything is technically possible.
You're saying, the football player you think did it because of the brain trauma.
Or because of his upbringing or because of anything, but he did, it doesn't need to be like, the color of his skin and the color of the victim's skin is unimportant to that story. And I think it is similarly unimportant in many of the stories where it is important, where it is given the utmost importance. And you will conclude that
this last cop was white, shot a black teenager who was trying to stab a black teenager. You could just leave off the races. You just say a police officer shot a girl who was trying to stab another girl.
Yeah. And even, Warren Farrell talks about this, does it matter that they're girls? Does it matter that they're... And I think some of these things do matter, but it's also... we mentioned this last week. When we're hearing single stories, of a single individual who died, you have to ask yourself why. Like, what is sensational about this? Is it the age of the person? Is it this? And is this something that is going to help me reduce suffering in the world to a meaningful extent if acted upon and legislated against? Or am I missing the bigger things that could save a ton of people? Mm-hmm. And when you hear those single stories, we're missing the things that the world and America needs in order to like really reduce suffering and help the most people, regardless of their skin color. Because to me, that's not how you should approach the problem of reducing suffering in the world.
Yeah. The one interesting thing that you pointed out, which I don't have data on, haven't run an actual study on, is just to pay attention to when race is talked about and when it isn't. If that makes sense. So like, when is the race of a victim talked about and when is the race of a criminal talked about? And you'll see that it tends to pop up more in certain cohorts than others, if that makes sense. So if the person who's doing the shooting is white, you're more likely to hear their race. If the victims are white, you're less likely to hear their race. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's just something we've seen anecdotally.
If you're a grad student, you want to run that study, go for it.
Yeah. But I thought that was interesting. I'm not saying it's true, but it's interesting to think about. And I have started to notice it when I just look at how the news is reported.
But it goes beyond that because like, we're not hearing about every gun death in America.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly. So it's like, you can't even see what you're not seeing. And this is why, unfortunately, and we have this podcast where we talk about the news because I've been unable to completely disconnect. Finds its way into my bloodstream somehow. But the things that you're not seeing are so important to context of what you are seeing.
Yeah, we don't get, not every police shooting is covered. So you don't even know.
Not every egregious police shooting is covered. And the most interesting question is, how is what is bubbling up to the top being selected? Mm-hmm. And that, what is the, if they were your eyes, what is the optical illusions that my eye is trained to show to me? And that's why I try not to act too much on the news. But what I do think is valuable are like broader trends. And that's why I like Ray Dalio, because he seems to be a
Because he looks at the last 800 years?
Yeah, he looks at the last 800 years and talks about, and he's like, yeah, we're going to print money because everyone always prints money, and then that always doesn't work. And like, it's good for a short time. Bubbles are great. That's what I saw him saying the last thing. He's like, oh, bubbles are awesome. He's like, bubbles are so fun. Everybody loves bubbles. And I was like, yeah, everybody does love bubbles.
Yeah, it's just when they pop that it becomes a problem.
We just mentioned it. Our Ivan, who works with us, has a TikTok. He talks about finance stuff. And at one point he went on and said, you know, that this particular cryptocurrency is got no use case. It's you know, Safe Moon or whatever it is, like all these meme stocks. And he received a lot of hate and pushback.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And what I told him to say, which I will say now, is that if you're out there in the world and everyone around you feels like they're getting rich and there's this, no, you're not allowed to pump the brakes, consider that those people who are saying that are trying to rip you off and have like bought into some scheme, want you to get in behind them to pump it up, just mm-hmm. like a Ponzi scheme so that they can exit. I think that's what's happening. Another thing that was, it's so fascinating. CoffeeZilla pointed this out. Chamath, who I have previously really, really liked, and I don't know how I feel about this thing. I don't know a ton about it. He's got this BitClout. Have you heard of BitClout?
No.
Okay. It's a social exchange that has a crypto layer on top of it. And what it does is it allows people to come in and purchase coins related to a particular individual. So the highest rated coins are Elon Musk, Justin Bieber, etc. And if those people come in, they can then claim their name and the coin that has been invested upon, some percentage of the coin that has been invested. I might be screwing up the argument here. In any event, in about like, I don't know, a couple of weeks, this has gone from a $0 to a $1 billion valuation. And he then contrasts that with a clip of Chamath earlier in his career saying that the half-life of a company is as long as it took to succeed. So he's like, it took Facebook 10 years to become a valuable company. So imagine that they have 10 years. And he's like, so what do you think, Chamath? Like, this was nothing a month ago. It's worth $1 billion today. Where's it going to be next month? And I think Chamath was right the first time around. I don't know how much back information has gone with this BitClout thing. CoffeeZilla does an interesting job, and it's too technical for me to really deeply understand, but of kind of pointing out that they're pumping up the valuations of some of these people. Like if you look at the primary investors in Elon Musk, they're the people who received the initial coin offering. So basically what happens at this is they give all the founders a bunch of money in this fake useless money and then try to get everybody else in. But in order to make Elon look valuable and other people look valuable, they invest in them. It's who knows what will happen with this BitClout. My sense is, and I hope it's not the case because I kind of viewed him as like a superhero guy, that it's BS and it's going to fail. And here's, I'll go out on a prediction, which is completely on a limb without a deep understanding of crypto or blockchain or anything. BitClout's going to disappear. All of these other, like Safe Moon's going away. Dogecoin is going to crash. And I'll put a time frame on that of 18 months. So if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I'm betting on that because I'm not investing in any of these things.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's my completely uneducated guess of this kind of stuff.
Well, I think my investing strategy, which will absolutely miss out on massive short-term gains, is try to make your money by doing something that is valuable to other people and investing in companies that are valuable to other people. So we had a friend who we were just talking to on the roof who invested a lot of money in a cigarette company because it has a high dividend. I would suggest to not do that unless you really like that cigarette companies exist, because there's other ways to get a high dividend by investing in a company that doesn't do something that you think is evil.
That's almost a third point. So like that company is creating value to its customers in the sense that they are electing freely to purchase those products. But you're adding a third piece, which is, do you want a world where this particular thing grows? Like, do you want to pay for this?
I would try to orient people towards, when you are making money yourself, it's because you're adding value for other people. And when you invest in something, invest hoping that it will, grow and that'll be good for the world. And also thinking that it's adding value to the world. So yeah, I guess there's three parts. And so if you think that Bitcoin is the future because of the use cases that you understand about the technology, and you think it will be the world's reserve currency, sure, buy Bitcoin. Think that's great. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to try to ride every coin to its 100x in a month gain. You know what I'm saying? But you also will, even when you lose 50% of an investment, be able to confidently hold, because you'll go, this is just a road bump. The company, the underlying company, is something I believe in and support. And it will not make you the most money, but I think it is a good way to safely make money and feel good about it.
Well, your other thing is, and this is the most boring investment strategy, is like, don't read the news ever. Dollar cost average in, because you're not trying to time a pop.
Mm-hmm.
And don't take out money for at least 10 years.
Yeah.
and therefore, there's no need to watch what anything does. Like, if you believe in Bitcoin, don't try to time it. Invest some today and take a peek in 10 years. That tends to be your investment strategy. And for all the money that you need tomorrow, get a job, start a company. Or like, if you need money next year, you work for that money and let your investments pay you back in a decade or more.
Yeah. And I think if you're an entrepreneur trying to start a business, think of the person that you're getting money from as someone you're meant to give value to beyond what they give you. Yep. And I think a lot of people, it doesn't seem to be how entrepreneurs are problem solving, or a lot of wantrepreneurs, I'll say, are problem solving what to start. Yep. It's kind of, how do I get mine as quick as possible? And yeah, you'll take sponsors that you don't believe in, and you'll ask, instead of asking for a revenue share, you'll ask for money up front because you don't think you'll deliver. You don't think your audience will actually buy. And you're trying to make a product that...
Let's slow down on that one, because I feel like we have some people who might want to do YouTube, and you just said something that they don't get. Do you want to repeat that?
Well, I don't even remember. I listed like four things.
for sponsorships, don't take sponsors that you wouldn't recommend, and for a couple of reasons.
Yep.
And there are legitimately self-serving reasons. If you don't totally recommend them, it is obvious to your audience, right? And we've done this in the past. We did a GoDaddy thing. It wasn't like GoDaddy's awful, but it's like, it's not...
It's a lesson I had to learn.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, then listen, my track record's not perfect. I'm learning as I go.
Sure, sure. But it's not that GoDaddy is evil, or like, it wasn't a cigarette company. I don't have any issue with GoDaddy's thing. It's just not, we're not stoked on it.
Mm-hmm.
If you can limit yourself up front and you reduce your sponsorship income because you're saying no to these mez, what happens is you build greater trust in your audience. And when you do recommend, what you can say is, I'd like a profit share.
Mm-hmm.
Like, instead of just paying me up front, give me a percentage of the money that you earn.
Well, let's talk. This is a good transition to a sponsor of ours. So there's something called Marketing Step by Step,
which we recommended last week.
I have genuinely recommended it to every friend who wants to be an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
So I can get on the podcast and I can very strongly recommend it. If I were to I don't want to bash anyone, but if I were to grab a random company that hit us up for a sponsorship, all I could do is describe their product, if I'm being honest. Go, oh yeah, we got hit up by this sunglass company. They sell sunglasses. If you want sunglasses,
keep sun out of your eyes,
you should buy it. Whereas with Marketing Step by Step, I go, this is literally the product that I recommend to every one of my friends and family who I love. It's amazing. You should definitely get it. So that does better for me, but it's also better for the audience, because when people buy it, they're going to get way more than their money's worth, which means the next time I recommend something, they're going to go, oh, this guy's trustworthy.
Let's talk dollars, because I think all of this money, by the way, is going into a bank account to help the podcast persist.
Yeah, it either goes to equipment or Justin.
We're not getting any of this money, so I don't even mind chatting about it.
Sure.
When we receive a sponsorship on this, we normally get like
a couple hundred bucks.
And that's fine. We have, you know, 10 to some thousand listeners, and they may or may not purchase depending on the product, and that's totally understandable. And just so you know, everything that we've done, we have recommended and tried. But this is one that is like emphatically, to your point, there's probably a dozen things that I'm emphatic about depending on what you're interested in. And this is,
I've been recommending this for 5 years, exactly. 8 years, whatever it is.
So when we said it on the podcast, and we'll continue to say it, a lot of you were interested, a lot of you bought, and we sold $10,000 worth of marketing step-by-steps. And we asked them, don't pay us upfront. Just like, look, if we don't sell any, we don't sell any. Give us half of the revenue of what you sell. So we made $5,000, which is more than 10 times as much money as we would make on a regular sponsorship.
Which means if I just took every crappy sponsor that contacted us.
Seven crappy sponsors and blew your guys' trust, we'd have less money.
Yeah.
You would be worse off.
And the other thing is this normally goes for $1,000. I happen to know the guy that runs it. We negotiated back and forth a different price, mm-hmm. and we have a link for $100 for this program, which mm-hmm. means that I feel very confident mm-hmm. that if anybody gets it, they're going to get way more than that in terms of value. So it's a win for them because they're getting a lot of value. It's a win for the company because they're selling a lot. It's a win for us because we're making more. So this selective high integrity process actually ends up being better for us, the audience, and the sponsoring companies.
But not in the short term. We are over a year and a half into this podcast.
Right.
We've not turned a profit yet. We probably could start to if we continue to do these sorts of things, but that's fine. We've got Charisma on Command. And Charisma on Command took a long time to get going. And this is to Chamath's point. The half-life of success, like delay it. You know, it's still good. You want to make sure that you have product market fit. I'm not saying delay product market fit.
No, a lot of people take the first sponsor that hits them up, no mm-hmm. matter who it is.
Or they sell a product that they're not proud of. And if you can slow yourself down and just focus on, am I really loving the thing that I'm making? Is my audience really enjoying it? Am I firing on all cylinders here? That will take more time and pay you back a lot over the long term. So anyway, that's... You know, we can get off the soapbox now, but
yeah. If people are interested, the way you get to marketing step by step is you go to ebonpagantraining.com/charisma. You get it for $97. This is literally, in my opinion, the best business course for people who are starting a business or run a business. It's about marketing and change Charisma on Command. It's the reason we're called Charisma on Command. It's been
changed our name. Yeah.
Hugely impactful on our success.
Somebody asked a question about this. Can we hop into it now? I don't know if you saw it. Somebody said, what did you learn from the program? Might as well just do it now.
Oh, is that a YouTube comment?
I saw it on Patreon.
Yeah, I have no idea which one you're talking about.
Oh, all right. You want to answer it? So we recommended marketing step by step. People want to know what we learned from it?
Yeah, you just mentioned one.
Well, the biggest thing I took from it is how to talk about your product, how to focus. I mean, this is the whole client focus kind of comes from marketing step by step, trying to figure out who are you creating your product or service for? How do you convey to them what you have to offer? Marketing step by step was hugely important for me in terms of learning how to communicate about Charisma on Command, how to write in a way that is persuasive or how to speak in a way that is persuasive. So,
I mean, I remember the exercises if you want me to.
No, go for it. Yeah.
So, one of the things that a huge mistake of beginning entrepreneurs is they fall in love with their product, and it's an ego exercise. They love what they do and they name it. You know, one of the most common things I know a number of people who are fitness trainers, and they always name their business Body by their name.
Yeah, yeah.
Body by Daniel. Body by this.
Charisma by Charlie.
Yeah, yeah. And it's because the business, which is understandable, starts from an ego place. This is me. This is my baby. I'm putting it out into the world, and the total shift is. Get away. This is about the audience.
What's the benefit?
So what is the benefit? And so one of the first things that we did was we changed our name. I used to call ours Kick-Ass Academy. And I thought Kick-Ass Academy, I was 22 years old. I was like, because it's cool. And I was going to, the other thing I was like, I was going to call it like fuck average because I was this super cool 22-year-old and I was anti being average.
Kind of angry at the establishment for the student loans and for the loans telling us charisma wasn't a skill yeah. and that it was like eye color.
And so Kick-Ass Academy to me was really cool. But what I didn't, and multiple people would be like, is that a dojo? Do you like beat people up? I'd be like, no, man. And I would re-describe to them. And it never sunk in that like, there goes a customer. There goes all of these people who think that you're some dojo are not paying attention to what you're doing.
Can I talk about your ex's business? Because I think that's a really good reading. I just
said it. Yeah, it was Body By...
So it used to be called Body By Her Name, and then it got changed to Painless Golfing.
Yeah.
Do you know that Body By Sarah, it's a fake name, right? Body by Sarah is...
we just said the name of a company if you guys want to stalk her.
So no, I'm saying when you hear that name...
We haven't dated for 3 years.
You don't know. You don't know what it's for. You don't even really know necessarily that it's for older men who are interested in golf. Well, you definitely don't know it's for older men who are interested in golfing. But when you know the company's called Painless Golfing and you're a golfer who wants to golf more but has body pain, it's immediately obvious that that's a good company for you to start to follow, maybe purchase from. So... That understanding comes from marketing step by step.
So the shift from Kick-Ass Academy to Charisma on Command was, you don't realize the other point that he makes is that the name of your business is the most important marketing decision you will ever make. And a lot of people sit around with their friends like, what do you like? What do you like? It's that's not how you do the most important marketing decision. You talk to your ideal customer and you talk about their fears, their frustrations, and their aspirations.
That's huge, those three things.
And so I sat down with the people that we wanted to be asking us questions, buying from us. And they were sometimes our close friends. They were sometimes friends of friends. They were people that had, that were like our favorite clients. And we asked them like, what do you want? And one of the things that you'll realize, particularly in the info business, but I think in anything, is the way that you think about a problem in the world is different than a way that a novice thinks about it. Mm. So for instance, a lot of people would come up to me and be like, I'm already charismatic, like I've got it, I'm good with my friends, and if I can just get like 20 minutes with the superior or a girl that I like, I'll knock it out of the park. And me, being self-centered, but also more knowledgeable than was like, that's not charisma, dude. Being likable around your friends is called being a person. You know, like being charismatic is knowing that you can get those first 20 minutes. So you're not, and I was contradicting them. I was like, that's not real confidence if you can't do it in the situations that are most important.
Yeah.
But I wasn't, so I was disagreeing with them. And then when I described their problem, I was like, look, you're not that charismatic. You can't turn it on when you need to. You don't have it. You're kind of lame. And that's essentially what I was communicating to these people.
And what Marketing Step by Step teaches you is you're not going to sell someone into your program
if you don't
meet them where they are in their own mind.
Yes.
So the reason you interview people and you ask for their words of their frustrations, their fears, and their dreams is because what you're trying to do when you market something is meet the person, your ideal prospective client, where they are, and then take them from there to understanding that the solution to the frustrations and fears that they're having or the method that they can achieve their dreams is with the product or service that you have. Yeah. And so if you can't meet them, it's like a map, but they don't know where they are on the map. Mm-hmm. It's completely useless. So yeah, the idea that you would interview people and figure out where they are and then start from there in your marketing. That came from marketing step by step.
So, and just concretely, that big shift for us was like, for instance, our buddy was captain of the Princeton football team, super successful. He became Forbes 30 under 30. And he was this guy who described himself this way. And he was very good buddy. But if I'd spoken to him and been like, so you're not that cool. It just wasn't going to click with him.
Yeah, ever. Yeah. You go, what are you talking about? I was the captain of the Princeton football team.
And so I had to say, look, you know that you can knock it out of the park. You just need those first 20 minutes when you feel on. And that was, he's like, yes, this is me. All I want to be is more consistent. And here's the truth. Both descriptions were true.
Mm-hmm.
They were both realistic descriptions of what was happening, but one was my perspective and the other was his. And you learn to use their perspective and to put yours secondary. So that was a big thing. We got the name from it. We got that. I'm sure.
It also just has, it has general persuasion. It just teaches you generally about how to persuade people. So it teaches you certain triggers. Some of them come from, Cialdini in terms of social proof and things like that. But then it'll also talk about other things like the importance of how do you build trust? How do you convey your authority? How do you do these things so that somebody knows that you're the right person to solve this problem or achieve this dream?
Yeah.
And so it goes through more at a psychological level, like what are the triggers you have to hit in order to take them on that journey from where they are to being really excited?
I would say that one weakness, and it's been years now since I've gone through it, but I think that he correctly, because it's a marketing program, focuses on marketing a ton. But the reason that I supplement this when I describe it for more advanced people with, I think it's Clay Collins's course. I think it's called the
Interactive Pre-Sell Formula.
It was called the Pre-Sell Formula. He's now rebranded at the Interactive Launch. We don't have a deal with him. Maybe we could look for one, but I think it's called the Interactive Launch today. What Marketing Step by Step does is perfect for what it does, but what it misses is how do you design your product in a way that is interactive with the marketing. Because marketing step-by-step assumes you have a pre-existing product, and ideally you don't.
Well, I would take the same lessons from marketing step-by-step and take them to the pre-product process, which 100%. Is to say, you still do the interviews in marketing step-by-step. You get your ideal client, you figure out their fears, frustrations, and aspirations, you ask them the questions from the program, and then you take a step back and assume you have no product, no service. You go, okay, what is the best way to solve these fears, solve these frustrations, and get people to achieve their aspirations? Yeah. And then you create something that does that, because that's going to be easy to market.
Yeah. Yes. So I'll see if I can find that link, but that's then the next step is it's not just the marketing. It's how marketing interacts with product development. So anyways, too much business, too much.
But no, it was great. I mean, it's a good question. It helped us a ton. It was very, very influential in helping us get out of the, low four-figure revenue a month situation that we were in.
So one other random thing, and then I don't know if you have more, but so Brian Rose is running for mayor of London.
Mm-hmm. I saw that.
He's the London Real guy. He's been covered extensively. He did the David Icke thing at the beginning. You know, COVID is 5G related. Has never really answered for that. Mm-hmm. and like, what are we missing? I'm open to, explain it, you know, run it down. How come, you know, I got it in December. Was there a tower that went up nearby that I didn't see?
Yeah, yeah. Well, this was my question is, why don't, if 5G causes COVID, why don't you see the most COVID cases in the highest 5G density areas?
And I truly remain open to explanations that I'd like to hear one.
Sorry, this is just a funny one. So that when I say that, I mean country by country, because actually it is in cities. It goes to densely populated areas. So someone did an amazing graph that Subway sandwiches shops cause COVID, because if you track where Subway sandwiches shops are located, it's where all the COVID cases go, because it just correlates to population. Yeah. But it's a great graph.
So he did that. Then he had the Digital Freedom Platform, where he raised over $1 million and was going to supposedly create this platform that competed with YouTube. Nothing exists. Spent $60,000 of those dollars on a live cast with David Icke instead of just recording it and then made, in my opinion, very questionable decisions, and is now running for mayor of London. And what's interesting is he seems to be trying to do the, you could call it the Steve Jobs, Donald Trump reality distortion playbook, where he has been insisting for months that he's in a shoe-in to win the candidacy of London. At best, at worst, second place. And what he points to are the bookmaker odds, which are easily moved by placing a bet on yourself. And he doesn't listen to the polls, in which he doesn't even register. The polls that are being done in London, he's in the 1% other category. And he says that that's an outdated form of you know, every poll that he does on the street says that he's a shoe-in to win. And I mean, I will, while I don't believe that, I'll maintain let's see. But my question for him is like, look, if this reality distortion thing doesn't work out and you don't show in the charts of people, have you not just burned your credibility to the ground? Like all of these years that you worked to build a ton of credibility. It seems kind of like an all or nothing gamble that I don't really understand.
Well, sometimes it's not true, because I was saying this with David Icke. David Icke was saying that Corona caused by 5G, and if that comes out just undeniably false, I don't think it will really hurt him much.
What's interesting is it almost the more outlandish the claims that David Icke makes, and I seriously remain interested in like. Explain it to me. You know, run me down why when I got it, Ben got it, and my brother got it, who I live with, and none of us, was there a 5G, but my neighbors didn't, who I don't talk to.
Like, it acted was 5G, a lot like a virus.
It seemed to be transmitted via, maybe the 5G made me weak or whatever, but it seemed a lot like a virus that was uninfluenced by 5G. And the further thing is like, if COVID goes away, and 5G persists, I don't know how to explain
it. I don't think it'll hurt him at all. I actually think it reminds me a little bit of people who say the world was going to end in 2012 because of the Mayan calendar.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody was hurt by getting that prediction wrong in terms of their credibility with their audience.
Well, there's stories, I forget what exact, you know, the doomsday cults who get it wrong and lose very few adherents.
That's what I'm saying.
It's always fascinating.
That's what I'm saying.
In any event, I don't know that Brian Rose has that same Alex Jones, David Icke.
Sticky level, audience.
Sticky of interestingness. So it just, to me, I just, either he wins and, oh my gosh, you were right, the polls were wrong all along, or he shows tremendously and it's like, holy shit, you were right. The polls, you're like, you got 30% of the vote. You didn't win, but like, still a win for your perspective.
Credibility.
But if he doesn't show, I've watched some of the videos and I go, man, you are really quadrupling down on this, it seems. And maybe what you're saying is, no, you're
why
not.
Why can't he just say that the, so how are they going to determine who got the second most votes? They're going to release it publicly?
They show you all the way down.
Who releases it?
I assume the City of London. I mean, every election in the United
States.
Well,
the City of London doesn't have a, you mean their version of the BBC publicly owned news is going to announce it?
So he's going to discredit the news station?
Yeah, who's going to announce it?
Yeah, I don't know, maybe.
How are you going to get your truth? Because his truth is he came in second. And he's going to tell you it.
I mean,
what's yours come from? Fox yeah. News? Fox News is wrong. BBC is wrong. They're lying to you.
Yeah.
They don't want the little man to even show on the polls.
Maybe.
So they're.
I don't know.
Well, you could just go deeper. Like, how are you going to disprove me? I tell you that the news is wrong.
You never. So what you're saying is you just keep betting. You just keep.
Just double down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it showed. Actually, you did show up on the polls. It's 2%. That's what they want you to think, because they want you to think that only established candidates can win. But the truth is, we almost had this, and if we had just gotten a little bit more, we would have won, and it'd be undeniable, yeah. And they're trying to discredit us so that the next Brian Rose can't
win.
Don't fall for it.
When I watch him, he seems to believe himself, and I wonder if he's...
He might still believe that. He might come in 10th and think he came in 2nd.
Yeah. To me, I find it fascinating. Because I know, you know, he's done his ayahuasca. He's done his stuff.
Do you think Trump thinks he won the election?
I think that, I don't know, man. I have no idea what Brian or Trump think. This is the truth. I feel like I could potentially have a conversation with Brian. He's more accessible than Donald Trump certainly is. But I'm fascinated. Like,
well, right now, Trump might be excited to get on the Charlie and Ben podcast. No one will take him. He's gone. He's gone from the world.
YouTube
would. He might be very excited to just get a platform at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Justin, reach out to Donald Trump for us.
Tweet him. Oh, he's not there.
Get Donald Trump on the podcast, Justin. But I think that's how you do it. I think you double down. You just say this is more. I mean, at least that's the Trump playbook. Is just more lies.
Yeah, I don't know. Anything else before we go questions?
No, it's two questions.
Two questions.
Sick. First one is, if you guys were parents, would you allow your children to have social media?
I mean, I am so far from wanting to be a parent, so this is tough for me to even. I've never thought of this. Let's put it that way. Do you have an answer?
Probably not. Yeah.
You wouldn't allow them?
I mean, at some age, of course, I would allow them to. But I would take the average age of whenever most parents are doing it, and mine would be after that. I think I would try to raise one. I'd probably move out of the city, go to a farther suburban or more rural, spacious area. I would homeschool them, probably with kids in the area, and would try to push the horizon of technological addiction back.
So the reason
possible.
I would love, if I had a kid, I would love for them never to use social media. But my hesitation comes from the fact that I'm not sure how successful being an authoritarian parent is compared to trying to raise a kid who.
So my parents never let me have soda. They never let me have soda. And my aunt, I'd go to my aunt's and I'd have like three.
No, this, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but what I'm saying is I don't know if I would be the kind of parent to tell you can't use social media or just try to raise you in such a way that I would. Try to get you to choose to use social media less.
You don't have a phone or a computer, kid. Good luck. When you can buy one, you can buy. Yeah,
That's a strategy. I don't know if that's the most.
This is my mom's parenting strategy. I mean, it worked for me with soda, which is, look, you can get soda. Go ahead. But like, you have no money and you live here.
So there's none
in the house.
So you would say, I don't care if all of your friends have phones. You just aren't going to have you have a flip phone.
Yeah, or I might get you some text device or something. Yeah, I'm not going to get you a phone. If you can play on your friend's phone, if you need to, like, I can't stop you. I could just really control what goes on inside of my own house. I would go crazy for Sprite, man. I get like three of them, but I didn't get addicted to it every day. That was just like when I had dinner, there were no Sprites there. Mm-hmm. It was a special thing.
Were you advocating for soda in the house?
I wanted it. I loved Sprite.
Were you advocating to your parents for it? And they were saying no?
Yeah, but it wasn't even a question. Like, I asked, but I just knew that there was no way.
I think you would get a lot of pushback from your kid if you wouldn't get them a smartphone these days.
Yeah.
If you're a 13-year-old kid, and you're like, no, you don't get a smartphone. They'd be like, I'm the only kid who doesn't have a smartphone.
Yeah, look, I don't know what age, but just take whenever it is. I'm just going to hold off for several more years, try to let their brain develop a bit more before that.
My idea would be that they didn't use social media or they used it as little as possible, but I don't know how I would go about that, I guess is where I'm at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I would actually be pretty laissez-faire, which is like, look, do you have any money? Like, then no, you can't have a phone. Like, you get the things that I give you, which I give you lots of cool stuff. We're going to have video games for sure because video games are dope. Like, you just can't.
That's fair. You just go, I'm going to treat you like an adult.
Yeah, yeah. Go buy
your by the way, while giving you a roof and food.
Yeah,
I'm going to give you a roof, food, TVs, video game stations. I give you a lot, but on the stuff I don't like.
You're not going to get.
You get it. Just get it yourself.
Yeah, just figure buy it out. Just go buy it. Go earn $1,000 for a phone. You're not going to do that before you're 10 years old. I'm going to do that saving up allowance. So, yeah. And then try to give alternatives.
Well, you know? Unless you have a Jewish wife and then you got a bar and bat mitzvah. That kid's getting it right on their 13th birthday.
Oh, damn. Fair point. Yeah, by 13, maybe they start to scrounge together. So I don't know. I've never been a parent. I also think it's probably hard when your kids are beating down your door, begging for stuff to resist. But I would sooner give them all of the other things that I complain for, which is like dogs and cats and animals and cool stuff and a treehouse and like all of that stuff.
No soda, though.
And or a vacation to Disney World or like, you know, all of that stuff I would do prior to social media, I think. And even if I did get them a phone, I'd have those annoying parental things on it probably. I'm such a loser. I'd ruin my kid's life. So that's my perspective. But don't listen to me. I've never parented anything. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
Next is point on the religion front. How do you feel about having a shared narrative story? I think it helps people understand each other, teach each other's kids, etc. Of course, you can do this without religion, but it's surprising how individualistic language can be at times, and religion forces a common language for deeper moral exchange. I know this is a tangent, but I do find the Bible to help cultivate morality through this mechanism, or at least it used to. Would love to hear your thoughts.
Do you want to go, or do you want me to go?
You go first. I mean, I have a response, but go ahead.
Yeah. So I have a lot of responses. So I'll start at the back end. You said the Bible creates good behavior, and that might be true in the last 50 years, but certainly that's less defensible through the lifespan of the Bible, where the Crusades and the Inquisition were all explicitly, the justification was pulled explicitly from the Bible.
I would guess more murder has occurred for religious purposes over the course of the Bible's life than through atheistic purposes.
No, because there's two big winners in the 20th century, which are Mao and Stalin, and they come in out of nowhere and just slay all the people who died before in terms of sheer numbers.
Interesting.
But I actually think the fair point is like, look, Mao was going to do that. Stalin was going to do that. The Inquisition guys were going to crack down on people. Like, I actually don't even know that the Bible drove any of that. I think probably it was just tribal violence, which you could summarize as Islam versus Christianity is what caused the Crusades. But really, it wasn't. The Bible wasn't doing it. It was just a justification font for it. So I don't necessarily blame a lot of those religious wars in the same way that I wouldn't blame atheism for Stalin and Mao. But they certainly pulled, at least ostensibly, the justification for a lot of that stuff was religious in nature. But I suspect it was actually economic and political, as is usually the case. So 50 years ago, Bible, shared narrative, people come together on church. I actually think that one of the things that you pointed out that religion does really well is it gives that shared narrative. Often has rituals that require gatherings, so you come together every Sunday. Sometimes, depending on the tradition, it has dancing, chanting, or singing, which builds cohesion and community. So around the Bible, including the story, I think there's a tremendous amount of value to a shared understanding of the world. And I think you're right. I think when you strip that away from people, suddenly they are susceptible to other stories, which could be worse than the one that the Bible tells. And some of those stories are, you know, racial supremacy stories. Some of them, in my opinion, are the woke Marxist stories of class struggle. I guess kind of what the way that I think about it is that the world is just a history of, not just, has tribal conflict throughout. And it sometimes is religious in name, sometimes it's skin color in name, but people tribe up and then they fight each other. And the best stories are the ones that creates the larger, more cohesive and peaceful tribes. And the worst stories are the ones that are the most warlike, and none of them are truer than any of the others. They all seem to lean on just false narratives.
So I just want to caveat this by, I'm absolutely not saying that religion causes people to commit crimes, but I just did some Googling. 1 in 100 Americans identifies as atheist. 1 in 1,000 prisoners identifies as atheist. So it doesn't seem like the absence of religion is leading people to commit more crimes, unless atheists just get caught way less.
I think this is correlation. I suspect.
I agree it's correlation. Yeah. That's my exact point, mm-hmm. is that if people who didn't have religion didn't understand morality, mm-hmm. then you would expect the prison population to have a higher density of atheists than the general population. The fact that it is the opposite, I'm not saying religion causes crime at all, but I'm saying the data doesn't seem to point out that in the absence of having a religion, people tend to become criminals or disunderstand morality.
Yeah. I guess, so I'm thinking, so you said, is there a value to a shared narrative? And what I'm thinking is, like, as a human race, there's 7 billion of us, and we're telling different stories to get larger groups to cohere so that we can not fight and do bigger things. And what are those stories? Christians, a brotherhood of Christians, which is like a billion plus strong. That's pretty dope. National identity is one of the other really strong things. You got a billion Chinese, you got, you know, 300 plus million Americans, and they do things together. What are the stories that enable larger group cohesion and less out-group demonization?
Well, the one thing I would say is, and potentially these did serve purposes in the past, what you're describing also prevents further unity in mm-hmm. the sense that if you are deeply nationalist, then you out-group people not from your country. Mm-hmm. And if your in-group is Christians or Muslims, then you out-group Muslims or Christians.
Yeah.
So you, at some point, your ideal would be that the in-group is humanity. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can't have that if you're going to divide based on religion or based on nationality or based on skin race color. Or based on something else.
Yeah.
So while they may have been useful in the past, if we think that further and further unity is good, less outgroups means less war and less hate, then at some point what you want to circle around is humanity. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but if you tried to race there, it doesn't work. Like
you need certain technology allows you to
genuinely connect and care and be personally impacted by people outside of your immediate sphere of sensory input. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, we're not the first people to be like, hey, what about a brotherhood of men or of humans? And by men, I mean men and women and children of humans, or even just like all living creatures, and maybe we'll eat some of them, but it just doesn't work at a certain level. I guess that's one of the impressive things about religion is pre, like, deep economic ties. It created large cohesive groups that were able to work together mm-hmm. because they were subordinate to God and the Pope and whatever religious authorities existed. And then you start to get the same thing with, you know, nationalities but there's few stories that can get groups to go so far beyond their own technological place in history as religious stories. Does it make sense? It's like you're making a claim about how the world was started, where you go after you die, if you'll suffer eternal punishment or eternal bliss. That's a pretty powerful story.
Sure. But it's kind of like in business when you say what got you here won't get you there.
Yep.
Like what got you to 6 figures of revenue won't mm-hmm. get you to 7 figures of revenue. What got you 7 won't get you to 8. Mm-hmm. At some point, if you want to get to the whole globe cares about each other as much as if they were one country, then you have to get rid of how deeply you care about just your country mm-hmm. and how other countries are worse.
Yeah.
And if you want everyone to be united in one humanity, then you have to be willing to love someone of a different religion as much as someone of your religion.
Mm-hmm. And well, I guess the other question which we were asking is, what is the policy towards the out-group? And so like the Jewish policy towards the out-group is like, forget them. They're not saved. You know what I mean? Like, but not screw them, not kill them. It's just like, whatever, we're cool. The Mormon or Christian is like, try to convert them. But then there are some groups which are today in 2021 is like the policy towards the out group is exterminate them. And so you want a large cohesive story that also is peaceful to the out group. And I think recently religion, or at least Christianity, has found its stride as far as I can think of in world conflicts. And there's been some, you know, George Bush invokes God's name weirdly when we're invading countries. There's definitely been some of that, but correct me if I'm wrong, that it has not been, there have not been holy wars in the last 40 years, I want to say, or large holy wars in the name of Christianity. Is that wrong?
I mean, I guess it would depend on how you feel about the war in Iraq.
Yeah, there was some. I honestly think that the American exceptionalism was a larger driver than Christian. You know, we're bringing the Christian God to them. The idea that democracy is just something that you show up and here you go. Here's an idea. You guys will be great.
Yeah, yeah. As long as they vote for the right candidate.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you depose them.
Yeah. Anyways, I don't know. That's my thoughts.
Last one I have is, oftentimes you will steelman an argument that you might not agree with, and usually you do a great job of representing the most compelling version of that argument.
Nice.
I want to get better at steelmanning an opposing viewpoint, but I have a hard time getting to the crux of what someone else is saying. Do you have any techniques that you use to steelman another person's argument?
I have a thought, unless you would like to go.
Go for it.
I don't try, so here's what, you know what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to not be wrong. Is what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to steel man the other person's argument. I'm aware that I'm on camera and that if I say something dumb or easily that you could easily poke holes in as an audience member, that you will. And so I'm covering my own ass when I steel man other arguments. Let me make sure I get this right.
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is if you, like, let's say that you like capitalism and you want to go argue against socialism, if you straw man socialism, you devalue your own argument for capitalism.
Yeah.
Anybody smart enough to realize you've given a weak opponent to yourself will go, yeah, this guy's made a completely uncompelling argument for capitalism. But if you give a great argument for socialism and then a more compelling argument for capitalism, it's a better argument.
Sure. So take socialism and capitalism. I'm committed to neither. I have like no preferred economic plan. Insofar as the podcast exists, like, I just want to look smart. You know, I want to look like I'm getting it right. And so that is what motivates me to go, well, you know what? We already have a tremendous amount of socialism in the United States.
So yeah, I was going to say, my ideal is a hybrid.
Yeah, yeah. Or something better. So I guess rather than focusing on the techniques of how one steelmans, it's like, do I want to walk out of this argument with the same perspective I came in as? Is that my goal? And therefore I'm steelmanning as just a perfunctory thing that I'm supposed to do? Or am I using the steel man to adjust my argument? And I think if you change the perspective on why you're doing it, you'll naturally be inclined to like really think through the perspectives of, because it's not yet my, I guess this is the other
you're
thing.
You're not doing it for the first time on air.
People should
recognize like what Charlie actually does, in my opinion, is you go into your bed and you try to figure out which argument is right.
I do it at night.
To the best of your ability. And you come up with the best arguments for both. And then you decide what you believe based on the best argument you could come up with.
Yeah.
And so then what you have is the best argument you could come up with for both sides. And then you present both and the conclusion you came to.
Correct.
You don't start with, oh yeah, I think this. What would the other side possibly think? You are doing an exercise before the podcast to try to decide what's actually the strongest argument. And then you come on here and you present the conclusion of your exercise.
Sure. Yeah, so, I mean, that happened with gender, you know, like many people. I was like, there's guys and there's girls. There's men and there's women, and we know that. And we know that because guys have XY chromosomes and women have XX. And then I guess one of the questions I ask is, well, how do you know? And I go, I don't. I've never seen a chromosome. Like, never in my life have I seen it. So that can't be it. Like, I'm clearly not walking up to people and going, I know what chromosomes you have. So I guess I'm looking at how tall he is and the structure of his face and his hair, like, and the clothes that he wears and the name that he tells me. But if all of these things are in the middle and he says that his name or her name is Drew.
Pat.
I go, you know, I'm not sure. So it appears to that's actually how I'm doing gender. And it really, doesn't, I'm almost never checking anyone's genitalia to confirm any of this.
Almost never the genitalia, definitely never the chromosomes.
Definitely never the chromosomes, almost never the genitalia. And yet I know it, or I think I get it. And I've been embarrassed when I've gotten it wrong in previous times of my life. So that has adjusted my stance on gender from some of the most common arguments, which is this chromosomal, where I just laugh at it. It's like, no one is checking chromosomes. That's just not how you're making this distinction. So anyway, that was what I did at night prior to thinking through some of the arguments that are inspired or the philosophy inspired by the trans movement.
The absolute hardest part is getting comfortable being a flip-flopper. It's not tying yourself to one side and going, if I do happen to form a literal steel man, steel tight, unbreakable argument for a side that I didn't believe prior to this mental exercise, then I will switch sides.
Yeah, yeah.
Or at least abandon my own side to I don't know, because now I have two seemingly unbeatable arguments. Mm-hmm. That's actually the hardest part for people. And That's what you do, is you just go, okay.
I try. I mean, I try. There's some times when I'm invested and I want to win for sure. But
the podcast is getting the results of the exercise. You're not doing it real time.
You said the other thing, which is if I am in an argument with someone and I am wrong, I am less likely to change my mind while in front of them than if I did it in advance. So this is why I argue things out in my head in advance, because I'm much more comfortable changing my mind alone in my bed than I am in front of someone that I'd like to beat while we're discussing. So I do spend a lot of time thinking about these things on my own, and I change sides three, four times, and then I'm in argument, and I no longer need to change sides because I've gone through that process.
You also read about this stuff. You read White Fragility. You read Warren Farrell. You're trying to understand what your side is saying. You're trying to understand what the other side is saying. You're not basing your opinion off of a two-paragraph Reddit post you found.
Yeah, yeah.
Most of the time, you're trying to go to source material. You read a lot more than anyone I know.
Yes, I try to find, I am genuinely interested in the strongest arguments for things that I don't believe, even though it can feel uncomfortable to listen to, because it'll...
Sometimes it makes you angry.
Sometimes I don't get deep and I go, you are so dumb. You are so, like, and then there's other times where I go through and I'm like, damn, never considered that. And I've experienced both of those. And so that's why I have stronger beliefs than others, because I feel like I've checked out like the champion of the other side. And I've been like, oh my God, like this is
so dumb.
I mean, we talked about one, and I think that there's interesting points in Marxism, but we talked about the one idea that the value that if there's a tree, this is the example that was given, and there's a capitalist and the capitalist throws money at the tree, it doesn't transform into a chair. Therefore, the capitalist adds no value. The worker who carves the chair out of the wood is the one who adds all the value, which is ridiculous, because if you already have a worker and you already have a tree and there's no chair, like clearly what the capitalist adds is incentives, takes risk off the table.
The tools, the marketing,
finds a market, like,
the customers.
So just that straw man argument against capitalism as this is dumb. Now, that's not to say that there's no value in a Marxist view of things, or that they might not have gotten some points correct. But that particular one, I was just like, this is so dumb. Same thing with Warren Farrell when he was like, war is bad for guys, but girls get to stay at home. It's like, until their cities burn down and their villages burn down. Like, what?
That's a tactic that you do often that I think people don't do, is what would the opposite of this be? That's just something your brain does. So someone says, if a capitalist threw money at a tree, it wouldn't become a chair. You immediately go, okay, that's fair. I agree. What if there was no, like, so the argument is without the capitalist, no chair.
Yeah.
And you immediately go without the worker, no chair. You immediately go without the capitalist,
no chair.
What happens?
Yeah.
No, you just go, what happens? Mm-hmm. So you often inverse an argument to try to understand if it's valid or not.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to do when people talk is people speak in words and dialogue. And I guess what I try to do is condense it down to the principle that they're asserting. Mm-hmm. And the principle in that particular argument is if you can subtract someone from a process, then all that remains belongs to the other person in that process. And so I did that. Okay, let's subtract the worker. Let's subtract the capitalist. There's a tree and there's a worker, and nothing. Like,
there's no commerce. there's no chair because there's no tools. And if there is a chair, there's no customer and there's no marketing. So there's no commerce. So
that argument.
But most people don't do that. They just hear the argument and they go, "Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting." And then they just move on. They don't inverse it.
Yeah, there's often a lot being left out. What's not being said in many of these things is important. And I see that in The Myth of Male Power, where he focuses sometimes, not all the time, exclusively on how war is, for instance, so detrimental to men's health, which it obviously is, but just, you know, says, and the men are fighting, and so the women can stay at home safely. It's like, kind of.
Yeah, it depends where the men are fighting.
Depends. Yeah, it depends where. Sometimes they're dying in droves as well, or being raped or displaced, or, you know, it's not just that.
Yeah.
Even though I like segments of his book. So that's all. Is that it?
Yep.
Thanks, everybody. We're going to hop over to Patreon now. If you guys want, we're going to answer more questions there. And for any...
How do people get to our Patreon? They want, if they like this and they want more content, what do they do?
Oh, gosh. If you're listening on audio, I have no idea. Do you know?
It's in the description.
It's in the description of YouTube.
Of the audio podcast?
Of the audio, yeah.
Of the audio.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, if you like this, we basically do another hour plus of content where we answer people's questions. And you can go to the description to join that Patreon. What is it, $3 to get in?
It is, I think, $3.
$3 a month.
Helps us keep the podcast going. In addition, luckily, our sponsor did well this month, but Patreon most months is what.
Oh, yeah. And if you want to check out Marketing Step by Step, go to ebonpagantraining.com/charisma.
Yep. Thanks, everybody. See you on Patreon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.